Welcome to Spectrum Policy 101, brought to you by Policy Tracker, which produces a newsletter, research and training courses about spectrum management. Hello, I'm Tim Jenkins with episode 2, looking at the key events which shaped spectrum policy. Now, in our first episode, we learned about the electromagnetic spectrum, the airwaves through which we send energy and information. Now, there's a lot of it, but it's not infinite, so we need to share it out, and that's called spectrum management. In this show, we'll ask how the airwaves were shared when we first became aware that it was possible to use spectrum to communicate without wires over a distance, when radio telegraphy appeared on the scene. Now, like most human endeavors, a lot of people were involved in the invention of radio. From the 1860s, folks with names like Maxwell, Hertz, Branly, Lodge, Popoff, and Bose were involved. Some of them got praise and success. Many were sidelined. And most of them were overshadowed by the man who monetized radio, Guglielmo Marconi. He helped push radio theory into practice and convinced the dominant power of the time, Britain, to sponsor his work. Britain was very keen on wireless telegraphy to its colonies and its ships. Marconi made a lot of money from this, and he didn't want to share it either. So let's hear more about that from Mark Raboy, who wrote the biography Marconi, the Man Who Networked the World. He joins us from Montreal, where he's a professor and emeritus professor at McGill University.
Hello.
Hi, Mark. Well, broadly speaking, Marconi refined the technology. He manufactured the equipment. So is it your thesis that he had pretty much a monopoly for a while?
Initially, and for the first decade or so, Marconi did have a monopoly. You mentioned a key word in your introduction, wireless. I mean, radio telegraphy, or telegraphy as it was known at the time, was the dominant communication technology in the latter half of the 19th century. Radio came into play with the discovery of what we now know as the airwaves by Heinrich Hertz in the 1880s. Marconi had an insight that telegraphy could be combined with this new means of, or this new medium, really, and you could get rid of the wires. And that was really his contribution. So Marconi pioneered wireless telegraphy. It was Morse code telegraphy without the wires, basically. And that was the first use of what we know now as the radio spectrum. I mean, the concept of spectrum didn't exist at the time. As you mentioned, there were many inventors, tinkerers, physicists, people who call themselves electricians, who were experimenting with the newly discovered radio waves. But Marconi was the first to develop a practical application by having this insight that radio waves could be used to communicate wirelessly.
No radio telegraphy, so no regulation of radio telegraphy. So he was operating in a rules-free environment. But because he had patents, he was able to call the shots. Is that right?
Yes. I mean, that was the first key step before really anyone knew what was going on. Marconi created a company, patented his what he called his system, which was really an amalgamation of various existing bits and pieces, and it proceeded to patent that everywhere in the world. I mean, the patent was the only asset of the Marconi company, and with his advisors, Marconi and the people around him, who were very, very astute business people, realized that they could lock down exclusive use of this and then see what happens. And what happened is that the technology and that means of communication became extremely important at the turn of the 20th century. And for several years, Marconi Marconi's company was the only entity that had the legal right to use the radio waves for communication.
Well, listen, that must have been very frustrating for other nations that wanted to get in on this.
It certainly was, particularly for the Germans, who soon after the time that Marconi was working, and incidentally, Marconi actually collaborated with some of the German scientists on the development of the technology, but he was the one who had the international patent on it. So there was a German startup, we would say today, supported by the German government, which was working on the technology, but Marconi managed to keep them out of the market internationally. And the German government was very unhappy about this because they were competing with the British for a dominant role worldwide generally, and communication was a very important part of this. So they wanted to be at the cutting edge, and early on decided that something had to be done to stop Marconi from consolidating this worldwide monopoly.
So, you know, we've had maybe radio telegraphy, wireless telegraphy for a few decades now. And it's not until, 1903 that some nations are called together to try to hack out what the rights and regulations over radio should be.
Exactly. So in 1903, the German government called five or six of the leading powers of the day, the UK, Italy, France, United States, very importantly, and Russia, called them to an international conference in Berlin to discuss some kind of consolidation of rules and regulations, really, for the use of the airwaves. Their main point was that anyone should be allowed to use the airwaves. And by that, they meant other people or other entities than the Marconi company. And as you might imagine, this was resisted by the British and by the Italians, because both of them had an interest in maintaining and developing their own exclusive relations with Marconi. But they also had supporters, notably France and, very importantly, the United States, because the United States was trying to was actually developing its own technology and was interested in playing an important role internationally as well. So there was an international agreement with some dissent from the British and the Italians. And by 1906, even the British and the Italians were on board in this, and there was an international convention that declared, basically, that anyone with the, you know, who had the technology and the capacity could use the airwaves. And that was the end of Marconi's monopoly.
Okay, but that sounds as though it's opened up a kind of a Wild West, really, with, I think there's a quote in your book about it being exploited by sensible practitioners, governments, and lunatics.
I don't know if I actually wrote that, but if you say so. Well, there were even early on, there were, you know, what came to be known as ham radio operators who were able to tinker with the technology, and this was, this was a secondary problem in terms of geopolitical importance. The fact that the airwaves, as you mentioned, the airwaves were a scarce resource, and interference was an issue. And so this was a technical reason, and which became part of the justification for regulation of the spectrum was the fact of, you know, kind of some kind of traffic control of the air.
So, like, we didn't have any rules of the road, any highway code, any rules for motorists because there were no cars. Eventually, we're starting to think about regulation, especially after the First World War. Is that right?
After the First World War, by the time of the First World War, there were multiple uses of the technology. I mean, it wasn't simply wireless telegraphy. We have what we actually know now popularly as radio, broadcast radio, had appeared, and that was a new application, if you will, that was layered onto the existing technology. And with the development of commercial radio and public service radio, and many players who actually wanted to use the airwaves for this new form of communication, there was a need to do, as you say, some kind of traffic control. And if you will, it's sort of like, you know, if we make an analogy, it's like if you have a four-way stop, you can't have everyone going at once. One person has to go, and then another has to go. And this is kind of a loose analogy for what was going on.
And tell me a little bit about the licensing of radio stations in the States as well. That was starting to gain pace as well. But then the biggest step, where would you say that was? Was that somewhere around 1927?
I would say the biggest step, certainly internationally, was with the Radio Convention of 1927, which was the first time really that the leading governments of the world sat down together and said, okay, what are we going to do with this? How are we going to set up the system in such a way that we can all use the radio spectrum without getting in each other's way, to our own needs and interests? And basically, as a result of that convention, the spectrum was kind of bits and pieces were parceled out first regionally and then at the regional level to national governments, so that for example, Canada, the United States, and Mexico, let's say, each had access to sufficient spectrum that they were each able to do their own thing, license their own stations, if you will, without them getting into each other's way. And there's a long history here, because of course, particularly in border areas and questions of high power and low power and so on, you still had issues that had to be resolved. But basically, there was a system, an international system, put in place.
Mark, you were actually born right across from a Marconi factory. So he's kind of overshadowed you ever since, is that right?
Well, yeah, that's sort of the heroic version of why I wrote a biography of Marconi. Of course, people are always saying, why, as I said in the book, I mean, when I was 5 years old, we moved into a new house, and just from the kitchen window, I could see this neon sign, Marconi. And it was probably the first time I'd seen a factory, and it was where they were making Marconi radio sets in the 1950s. And in fact, I think people all over the world had an experience like this because Marconi was and continued to be a dominant player worldwide in this industry right up until, into the 1960s, I would say.
Thanks, Mark. Well, listen, that's smashing. You've taken us basically from the start of radio to the start of regulation. So let's push forward now and see how regulation became a lot more professional. And across the border in Southern California, Professor Tom Hazlett joins us. He lectures in economics and used to be a chief economist at the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission. So Marconi, a big guy there, Tom. So important that actually the United States thinks of setting up its own nationalized company to rival him.
Yes. Yeah. And just to clarify the term nationalized, it was a national champion, but it was privately owned. And it had rules, however, that it had to be mostly U.S. owned. It could not have, I believe, more than 20% foreign stock ownership. The president of the company, I believe, was a retired Navy person. And the U.S. government had a hand in selecting those executives. So it was an American firm that was explicitly created to counter the influence of the British Marconi Company, as it was called.
Okay, well, that makes sense. And in fact, in your writings, you describe an era of broadcasting chaos as ending right about 1927 with that big convention. And then something called the Radio Act in the States as well. So listen, are governments now happy to regulate spectrum at last?
The idea of broadcasting actually, and by the way, the term is an agricultural term. You don't plant your seeds one at a time. You broadcast, you throw it out there just in general. Well, that's what broadcasting is. You go to a relatively high point in your market and you put up a tower and you blast emissions in all directions on what's called point to multipoint. So you're at one spot, you're trying to hit all these radios, all the receivers. It's a one-way transmission, but you're trying to blanket an area with a lot of energy. That was not something the government anticipated, certainly. That was just people experimenting, lots of experimentation, but the one that really stuck was November of 1920 in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, a station that's still on the air, KDKA, started 24/7 broadcasting, continuous daily broadcasting, and that's when it took off. And within that was just using an old radio license that was thought to be a point to point, but they went what we call omnidirectional broadcasting. And within 2 years, 500 of these stations popped up. And the U.S. regulators at the Department of Commerce, led by the a very brilliant engineer whose name was Herbert Hoover, later became president of the United States, he said that the Department of Commerce would assign licenses so as to minimize interference. And they were doing it, so they had some regulatory authority. But it happened so quickly, the government was just catching up. And they actually had to come up with some rules. There were so many hundreds of stations on the air in the United States, they had to come up with rules. And what they did, interestingly enough, is they adopted what the Brits would call common law. Once a station was broadcasting in a given market, they had a right of user or priority in use interest in doing that. And the Commerce Department would not assign new rights unless the existing broadcaster agreed to it. And that was the first regime in the 1920s. Under that regime, there were over 500 stations that really built a business and millions of radios were sold. The industry took off. 1924 was called Radio Christmas by Madison Avenue advertising executives who were pushing radio as the new, you know, this does not sound different from, you know, the latest iPhone release in our electronic age.
Okay, so you're talking about a really vibrant radio activity space in the United States there, and regulations growing almost as a result of that. Do the Europeans take a more top-down approach?
Well, yes. The United States, again, had this almost organic development where, you know, radio was this point-to-point communication. It was used really as an application by early on with Marconi selling to stock traders in New York and London that wanted some quick exchange of information that was highly valuable. Newspapers wanted news quickly, and there were point-to-point applications. Certainly the military saw the importance of radio. In World War One, you obviously had all armies essentially using radio in communications. So there were particular applications. Again, they were not mass market applications. They did not involve, you know, hundreds of thousands or millions of radios. That comes in with a new business that's discovered in the United States, which is this broadcasting. And so the broadcasting industry is out there and established before before anyone, the government included, really knows what's going to come of this. Other countries saw this, like Britain, for example, and said, let's be a little more careful about this. Let's put radio is going to be very influential. And it was seen that sometimes, you know, I think it's argued that people didn't understand how socially or culturally important radio was. I think that that's nonsense. There's all kinds of commentary in the early days of broadcasting about how absolutely essential this new form of communication was. And it was very exciting. And the argument was, do you want there to be free speech, so to speak? David Sarnoff, who became the president of the young the young entrepreneur who rose and became the president of RCA and very important in the development of radio. He was a very big free speech champion, did not want the government to control the market. But in other countries, it was primarily so important, so to speak, and there was no First Amendment in the other countries. It was so important, it was seen as politically and culturally of key interest to policymakers that there were, in essence, state monopolies. By the way, those state monopolies later came to be called PTTs, post, telephone, and telegraph. And they would generally control the post office, radio, television, and other forms of telecommunications like telephone service. So that kind of interest was in, you know, generally the non-US countries. The US, in some sense, stood alone. You could also see that we had a private phone company, American Telephone and Telegraph, some smaller ones as well. But we basically had a private, large private monopoly, AT&T, dominating telecommunications as well, when other countries had, BT or Bell Canada and NTT in Japan, Deutsche Telekom. In other words, and those monopolies tended to be privatized much later, the 1980s for the most part. By the 1990s, they had a system much more similar to the U.S. But the U.S. did split off.
And it's interesting that there's a lot of money in this already from the very get-go, with Marconi making money from his patents and licensing and manufacturing equipment, the manufacturers making that stuff later on, RCA and so on. So there's a lot of money to be made here. But why was it so much later that the idea of buying and selling the airwaves themselves, spectrum, came about? When did that start being thought about, and when did it come into practice that we bought and sold spectrum?
Yeah, the actual use of markets to assign these wireless rights was actually from the earliest days of what I'd call spectrum scarcity, which was the 1920s in the broadcasting era. You had radio stations being bought and sold, and they were sold with the radio rights. And this was a policy that was not only acknowledged but enforced. Endorsed and enforced by the Department of Commerce. And so this idea of actually buying rights in the marketplace is going on from day one. Now that continues, of course, all the way through the 20s, 30s, and up to the current. But what happens in 1927 is the idea that the government has to make all the initial assignments. And in fact, the first line of the 1927 Radio Act, which again is still the law of the land, the first act says that there can be no assertion of a private interest or ownership of a channel against the United States government. Okay, that's flat out saying that the common law that we've been observing, and in fact, in one case that was important to the senators who worked on this bill and put it the actual 1926 opinion in the congressional record, that the courts had been moving towards actual private ownership rights in what they called the ether. They thought there was some kind of a gaseous substance that these signals were traveling through. It turns out they just go through dead space or the atmosphere, whatever it is. They don't need ether. But at any rate, that there was a legal development towards private ownership. And in fact, the United States stopped that explicitly in the 1927 Radio Act. And other countries have basically done the same thing, that you can't assert a right against the government. So what happens under that system is that the government makes determinations as to how spectrum will be used, what technologies, what services can be delivered, what business models. For example, if you have a television broadcasting license in the United States on spectrum set aside for the purpose in 1952, you have the right to have an advertising supported commercial service, but you do not have a right to have a subscription service. That's all limited. Foreign ownership is limited. There are many things that don't have anything to do with interference, but just have to do with government discretion over how airwaves are used. Part of the discussion all through this time, though, was maybe the government is giving away something valuable when it does award a private company a license. Why don't we sell that to the highest bidder? And in the 1950s, a famous economist who ended up winning a Nobel Prize for some of his related work, Ronald Coase, actually a British subject by birth who came to the United States after he finished with the London School of Economics. He had he famously suggested this, and it was thought to be a very radical suggestion that would not work. To have these auctions. He pointed out that the auctions had been going in secondary markets for decades, which is what I just mentioned. And he thought that the government should at least try it as an experiment. So that became an actual debate in Washington all through the 60s, 70s, and 80s. Republican and Democratic presidents actually wanted the auctions, but members of Congress, particularly those who were involved with regulating radio, the head of the Commerce Committee in the House and the Senate, were always very much opposed. They would rather have a more political system for assigning rights, and they stopped auctions until the opening days of the Clinton administration, the 1990s. There was a unified government, all the same party, a Democratic Party for both houses of Congress and the presidency, and there was a Clinton administration with a new Secretary of Commerce who really wanted this auction. They thought it was a government efficiency, a good government reform. The Republicans did not oppose it. There was a bipartisan effort to get this done. And so in 1993, there was a big breakthrough there that auctions came in, were introduced the following year, and now over $300 billion in auction revenues have been raised. And in somewhere between 75 and 100 separate auctions that have been held in the three decades since. So that's come to the rest of the world. Obviously, many countries, including Canada, the UK, countries in Africa, Asia, Europe, all over the world are doing auctions to assign rights. And that system seems to work pretty well in terms of getting a more competitive way to assign licenses, generate some revenue for the governments, and in fact, speed up the whole process of getting those rights into the market.
We're getting used to the idea that there's so much competition now. It's really fraught between all of the potential uses of the electromagnetic spectrum. The Internet of Things, as well as, you know, the traditional broadcasting means and point-to-point telegraphy, controlling satellites, radio astronomy, all these guys fighting here. But I wonder if you'd say, Tom and Margaret, I'll start with Tom, that in a way there's always been a kind of cauldron of competing interests, and this is just another era of that.
Well, yes and no. I mean, yes, of course. You go back to the 1940s and 50s. By the way, I like to ask students or other audiences I might have the opportunity to speak to about when do you think cellular telephones were developed or conceived, anyway? And the answer is 1945 at Bell Labs. And it literally was a matter of getting spectrum allocated all through the post-war period, all the way up until 1968 in the United States, when finally the regulators took up the matter. But then they spent 14 years fighting over the rules and the actual way that the service would be introduced. And it wasn't until 1982 they settled on that. It wasn't until 1984 to 89 that the licenses were all distributed across the United States and we could actually have cellular. This was a long, at least a 30-year delay. You can say, well, technology got better. Yeah, it got a lot better, but it would have gotten even better still if you had had actual deployment possible with licenses in the market. The real problem was that the eventual allocations, the spectrum, the airwaves that were allowed to be used for wireless telephone, mobile, came from the UHF band that had been allocated from the late 30s to the early 50s, had been allocated to over-the-air broadcast television. And the television broadcasters tended not to like the government saying, we're going to strip away some of your potential spectrum assets and give it to this other industry. And there was literally decades of bureaucratic inertia that is accounted for by that consideration. Now, that was, you know, a waste of time, a waste of technology, slowed progress, scientific and in the business world. Consumers did not get the products that were available to them. And so regulators, economists, others have, you know, there's a lot of consensus on that point. Things went too slowly. Delays should be remedied. We're in a world today where, as I say, technology doesn't solve these interference problems. It exacerbates them.
Well, Mark, what are your thoughts on that? I wonder if we've learned along the way, we've got better ways and techniques, including the market system, to regulate spectrum, to decide who gets to use spectrum. Or do you wonder in some ways whether we've gone back to some kind of Wild West situation where you've got an awful lot of gunslingers really challenging each other to get hold of spectrum?
I think in a sense we are back to the Wild West. I appreciate it. I mean, Tom makes a very powerful case for market regulation, but my own view is that along the way we've lost a few things. In the history of broadcasting, for example, I mean, right alongside the U.S. commercial model, we had the very powerful UK British model of a public service monopoly, which became the BBC, and of course that evolved over the years. But in most parts of the world, we had some kind of hybrid system that evolved, where you had public service stations and commercial stations. And I think this what I'm trying to get at here with regard to the present day is that, you know, society has a kind of agency in this. I mean, we can, as a society, say we would like this new technology to be used in certain ways, and how can we get there? And you know, and the market obviously has a very important role to play in that. But it's not only all about the market. Maybe this is a very Canadian view of things, but Tom also made the point, which that new technologies are always disruptive. I mean, we have a way. We may be happy with the way things are, and certainly the legacy companies are often the happiest about the way things are because regulation tends to play in their favor. And then a new technology comes along, new players come along, and all of a sudden, wait a second, you know, we've got this regulatory system that's protected our position over all these decades, and now you're saying that you're not going to protect us anymore. I mean, so there's a lot going on here. I think it's important to bear in mind that we have, I mean, spectrum is in a sense, it's a natural resource. Now, as a natural resource, one could argue that it ought to be considered a public resource. And this was basically the argument that was made, 100 more years ago, when governments decided that something new has come along here, and we want to be involved in deciding how it's going to be used.
Mark Raboy and Tom Hazlett, thanks very much for talking today.
It's been a pleasure.
We're going to be looking more at how you can use the market system, buying and selling, to decide spectrum use in our next episode. What ways are there of auctioning spectrum? Do the richest companies get away with the best each time? Is the marketplace delivering the most good for most of us? Join me, Tim Jenkins, again for Spectrum Policy 101, brought to you by Policy Tracker. And if you'd like to find out more about policy issues relating to spectrum management, please take a look at Policy Tracker's training courses, newsletter, and research, all of which is available on our website, policytracker.com.